I'd like to welcome you to today's session. I'm Marvin Landsverk, and this week I've been talking about a series of things on myth, religion, and the hero's quest. And today's session is called In Which God's Image? Comparative Cosmologies and Creation Stories. And when I think of comparative cosmologies, I always think of parachuting. And this sort of a weird connection, but this student of mine told me this story about this guy that was going parachuting for the first time, and he's getting all his instructions. He'd never done it before, but the guy said, okay, you pull this first. And he said, well, what happens if the parachute doesn't open? And he says, well, then you pull this one over here. He said, well, what if nothing happens when I pull this one over here? And then he says, well, then you need to pray to Buddha. Say, please, Buddha, save me. And the guy said, okay, I got that down. Pull this one, then pray to Buddha. So he's up there, jumps out of the plane. It's going down. He pulls the first one, and of course, nothing happens. And so he says, okay. Then he pulls the second emergency ripcord. Nothing happens, of course. And he's falling down. He's saying, oh, yeah. And then he says, please, Buddha, save me. And this big bronze green hand comes up out of the sky and catches him, sets him down. And he goes, oh, thank the Lord. And this hand comes out and goes, splash. just thinking about images of God, what Holden's theme again this summer, in the image of God, whose image do we think of when we think of God, and what is there in the images of God from other religions, mythologies, ways of thinking that can impact our own, influence it, broaden it, or be useful. And comparative mythologists like Joseph Campbell make claims, or Campbell does, not all comparative mythologists, but he sees all myths as expression or explorations of the experience of being alive. And for Campbell, then, all myths are spiritual expressions that are valid and that all of them are useful. And that's why I think Campbell is so fun to watch, because he's so enthusiastic about all myth. He never saw a myth that he didn't like. And I think, I mean, that can cause maybe some troubles, and yet I think it's a useful way to think to a point. And the whole point of his series is that myth is good for us, and especially the myths from other cultures than our own. Because, he says, we tend to think of myths from our own culture as reality, our own religion as reality, and we see other cultures' myths as myths, so it's easier to read them symbolically, perhaps, than it is to read your own. So that's why Campbell's such a big advocate for reading other cultures' myths, and seeing them as symbols. Also, it's not just that, but he also emphasizes the importance of looking at the history of your own culture's myths as well, and the history of your own culture's images of God. And those two things, looking at some other cultural images of God and the history of your own, I think, sort of put a stamp on what he's up to, and partly what I'd like to do today. And keeping in mind the structuralist definition of myth that I tend to think of when I approach mythology, that sort of that binary opposition. We create myth, myth creates us. Sort of the way structuralists approach myth. We create stories, those stories create us. Can't separate those two, they're two halves of the same thing, and you could start with the first one, stories create us, we create stories. You could phrase that differently. Cultures create myth, myth creates cultures. And part of what that means, myth is always going to be the product of a specific culture, a specific landscape, a specific history. And also, that landscape, that history, those people will be the product of that myth. As I suggested earlier in the week, that's one way to think about then what it means to say God created us in God's image. In that structuralist definition, we create God, God creates us. It's sort of that mystery of Christ as the incarnate God. That is Christian way of thinking about that. So, from Campbell's point of view, and I think from mine, we need to ask then what we know about the cultures that produce the images of God that we possess. And another way to say that, we need to ask what we know about the cultures that create the myths that created the God that created us. So that's what I'd like to do. And to ask then the question, how much of that imagery of God remains valid for us today in this room? And is there some of that imagery which might not be? And I think that's the question that really that leads from some of the things we were talking about yesterday. I don't know how many people were here yesterday. So some of you. I think that particular question, how much of that imagery of God from particular cultures remains valid for us today? Again, I think in my point of view, sometimes Campbell, when he's focusing on the mystical function myth and the hero formula, forgets part of his the rest of his approach to mythology. But that question raises questions of, that you have to interpret mythology. Take a look at the specific time, its culture's history, gender, and power relations to be able to interpret a myth, which when Campbell's thinking hero formula, saying all myths are good for you, I think sometimes he tends to forget. All myths is good for you, here's how you interpret a myth, can lead to some pretty, I think, wild interpretations. Like Campbell will interpret Zeus' rape of Io as Io's hero quest. And I think that there's some problems there. Blake, I talked about Blake last week, and since I've got this, I'll talk about him some more briefly. Blake has a version of that same question, of how much of our image of God are we going to retain from culture's past? And this is Blake's sort of mythic expression of that question from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Blake says, "The ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by names and adorning them with the properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And particularly they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity. Till a system was formed, which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began priesthood, choosing forms of worship from poetic tales, and at length they pronounced that the gods had ordered such things. Thus men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast." Is Blake's point there? Is that clear? I think what Blake is saying is an earlier version of that structuralist definition of myth. We create gods, we create myth, myth creates us. And in Blake's version, all deities reside in the human breast, isn't an anti-religious statement. Blake's a very much a Christian, but he emphasizes the fact that the God you know is the God within, and that's the mystery of Christianity for him. So anytime you abstract that deity from yourself, you're creating a system, organized religion, and organized religion, to Blake, always leads away from myth, not back to it. Campbell makes a very similar point. In fact, Campbell is a Blakean. He thinks like Blake, heavily influenced by him, I think. And Campbell's similar point is that he says myths, religions tend to, myth and religion deals in metaphors. That's what sort of all these stories are, but that religions tend to concretize the metaphors or freeze the metaphors. And once you do that, says Campbell, you kill the myth. This is his approach to things, but that's exactly what Blake is saying. So Blake's saying you've got these poets who are expressing this religious poetry, and in the creation of the poetry is the creation of myth stories. People come along and say, good story. Let's write that into a book. And he's got other versions of this. Let's put in a book. Let's put that book in a library, and then let's turn that library into a canon law, and then everybody has to follow it. And pretty soon, culture changes, and it has no connection to the original poet's creation of these stories. So that separation is created, and pretty soon you've got dead religion, no longer myth. So again, just to frame the question, I mean, our image of God, our cultural image of God, how much of it from the beginnings is still valid? And have religions too often, Campbell would ask, Blake would ask, frozen our imagery of God sometime in the past and not allowed it to change? I think one of the best locations to see a culture's image of God is in its looking at sort of its cosmologies. And this is moving from what we were talking about yesterday, the mystical function of myth, to the cosmological function. And Campbell says all myths have four functions. They have a mystical function, and that's asserting a radical union between the material and the spiritual. That's what he's doing when he's talking about hero formula. All myths also have cosmological function. They give you a picture of the cosmos that's acceptable to the science of the time. And the other two, myths have a sociological function. They define who a people are. Here's us, here's them, we're different from them. And then a pedagogical function, just the teaching function, teaches you how to live a human existence at any time. But it's in the cosmological function, I think, that you really see images of God. And especially where you see the cosmological function of myth is in creation stories, when the God is creating and setting things up and creating people in the world and establishing those relations. And if you're looking at creation myths of any particular religions, you're sort of, I don't know, maybe biasing things in advance because you're going back a ways to foundational stuff. And our images of God aren't just set in how we view the creation, and yet In the way we interpret those creation myths, that continues to change. So that's what I'd like to focus on today are some creation myths and their cosmological implications. And you probably know this story, but thinking of creation myths and arguments about creation, the guys out playing golf on the golf course, the surgeon, the lawyer, and the architect, you know some version of this, I'm sure. They're all out there, and they start arguing over whose is the oldest profession. And the surgeon says, oh, of course mine is the oldest profession. Just think in Genesis, God creates Adam, or Eve, out of Adam, cuts him open, pulls out the rib, and creates her. If that's not surgery, I don't know what is. And the architect says, yeah, but what about the creation of the universe? God created the world before he created Adam, and he created that out of chaos, and if that's not architecture, I don't know what is. And the lawyer said, yeah, but who do you think created the chaos in the first place?
I should have never told you that.
I know. Is that the origin of that joke? I can tell that joke because I've got lots of lawyers in the family, and there's one. Anyway, I think creation stories and cosmologies are interesting, not just because they give us an image of God, but they give us an image of God in relation. And that's particularly four relationships, I think, that are interesting to take a look at. And that's, you get a picture of chalk here. God's relationship to the world or the creation, and you get God's relationship to people's relationship to the world, and then men and women. Usually some sort of relationship gets set up between men and women too, and that gets into sort of the sociological function of myth too, and these things overlap. So what I'd like to do is look at Greek and Hebrew creation stories, taking a look at the image of God that's presented in those. I think the two most influential mythologies on Western culture, not necessarily the most influential impacts on our image of God, and yet certainly Greek and Hebrew mythologies, Judeo-Christian tradition impact us in so many ways it's hard to even comprehend. But before I do that, I'd like to give just a brief history of cosmologies in general. So a brief history of the universe from time's beginning, which is what creation stories are doing too. And this is really sketched, but I think useful to think about. And that's from Paleolithic time, 70,000 BC, up till about 3,000 BC, not much is known about those Stone Age people's myth, religion, spirituality, or anything, because not enough is left in the record to really even speculate. So you get all kinds of speculations going on. Are these hunter-gatherers, and what type of religions and mythology would hunter-gatherers have, or what? And there's lots of argument about what's going on then. But when you get to the Neolithic period, from about 6,000 to 3,000 BC, the rise of agriculture taking place. It seems fairly clear that with the early rise of agriculture in most regions, what rises with agricultural development is female goddess worship. So early societies tend to have female fertility goddesses that they're worshiping, and societies that reflect that, that tend to be matriarchal. So the earth, which gives rise to the plant, is the earth mother. And so the goddesses that are worshipped are earth mother goddesses, and sacrifices made to them. And again, not a lot of details are known about much of this mythology, because this is before writing existed in many of the areas. And so we don't have written versions of the mythology to provide interpretations of the archaeological record. And what gets found, and what sort of leads to the speculation about this must be fertility matriarchal cultures, is what they dig up mainly from this period are little figurines. You've seen these little feminine, female fertility symbols with enlarged breasts, and very few male phallic-oriented deities. So conclusions are sort of in that period of early agriculture, earth goddess. And the evidence gets, you can track it through the mythological record too, which I think this is where things become interesting. So with this emphasis on cycles, farming, earth mother, that's the mythology you've got. Once agriculture starts to develop, and in about 4,000 BC, so it happens fast, agriculture starts to become more manual labor intensive when things get developed, plows and whatever. And as it starts to require more physical strength, then men start to take over the control and be valued. And about that time, 4,000 to 5,000 BC, you see the emergences of patriarchal cultures with male gods associated with them. And at the same time, and depends on what region you're talking about, these are just big generalizations, nomadic raids taking place all the time, and nomadic peoples, like hunter-gatherers, tend to have male gods and patriarchal religions. And so nomadic raids taking place in this time on agricultural sites, agriculture changing, so you get sort of the dominance of patriarchal male sky god mythologies, which then really takes over most of the developing regions, so that the feminine earth mother mythologies get absorbed and rewritten, or some type of a combination takes place. Now, a combination usually takes place in some regions, so you get this interesting blend, and I think that's where things, when you're reading mythologies, become most interesting to me is to read them to see the blends. And we can take a look at some of that. But I think an interesting example of that transition, and you can see the transition not just from archaeological evidence, but in the myths themselves. And it's a myth from Sumeria, from Babylon, and the story of the Enuma Elish, and the whole Gilgamesh epic is connected to this. Some of the most ancient myths that we have saved tell the story of this takeover of male gods from the female gods that used to rule things. And let me just tell that story quickly. I think it's interesting to read in it sort of that evidence. You know the story, the Enuma Elish? I'll give you a quickie version, or semi-quick. It goes back, I think, the written versions of this they got are about 1000 BC, although sort of it came into form about 2000 BC to 2500 BC. And so at the time, this story emerges, is the time when male sky guards, gods, the patriarch was taking over from what preceded it, Earth Mother religions. And you can see the record of that transition in the story, because there's references to the ancient old mothers who are sort of these deities that hang around in the background, and lots of mythologies will have this, that sort of have power, and it's scary, but the stories is of the male gods rising up and taking power. So this story, in the beginning there was only water. All these start to sound fairly familiar. In the beginning there's only water. Father Apsu was the god of sweet water, fresh water. And Mother Tiamat was the goddess of salt water. And both of them mingled their waters together and lived as one. So there's no even separation. They had a child, Mumu, a son who became the mist that hovered over them and sheltered them. There's no heavens and no earth, nothing but water at this point. Eventually, out of this mingling of water came other offspring. Anshar and Kishar were formed, who became the parents of Anu, who rose and became a male sky god of the heavens. And, this is interesting, also, Yah was formed, another son who became god of the earth. So you've got this male sky god, male earth god, both as sort of powers. Tiamat, Earth Mother, one day was disturbed by her offspring having a party. And they were dancing and carrying on upon her belly in a way that distracted her, and she couldn't get any rest. So finally she went to her husband and said, Apsu, you've got to do something about these kids of yours. I can't get any sleep around here anymore. Do something. So Apsu goes and talks to the kids, and they ignore him, and the party goes on. This sounds familiar too, doesn't it? Finally, the old gods have a council, and they say, we've got to do something about this. And Apsu's solution with his son Mumu's advice is, the only thing we can do is throttle these kids. So let's kill them. Let's just get rid of them, and then we can have some peace and quiet around here. And Tiamat's response is, you can't kill your kids. I mean, these are our kids. This is a terrible, evil solution. There must be something else to do. But they say, well, we're going to do what we're going to do anyway, so you go back and we'll make this plot. So the other gods hear about this plot, that here comes the parents to kill them. And Yah uses his magic to make Apsu and Mumu fall asleep before they can come attack. And while Apsu is asleep, he kills him, cuts him up, destroys him. Instead of the father destroying the son destroys the father. Again, this is Oedipal stuff. Sounds familiar too in mythology. And out of Mumu, he turns him into a pet. So he sticks a ring in his nose and leads him around by a string to show, you know, we've got power over you. The story continued that Yah lived then on the body of Apsu, who he had killed. The body of Apsu becomes the earth, and he lived on on Apsu with his own wife until finally they gave birth to Marduk, great Babylonian hero later, who is the best, the biggest, the greatest of all gods. Fire comes out of his mouth. Glory surrounds Marduk. Everybody knows that this god surpasses all other gods. And sort of contrary to the Greek versions of the same thing, Yah isn't jealous of this son. He thinks this is the greatest thing, so prays Marduk around.
I can't quite hear the name. Mark?
M-A-R-D-U-K.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and in the meantime, Anu is still around, and he starts blowing these winds and starts having another party, this wind party, and starts to blow these winds so it disturbs the waters of Tiamat. And it gets her upset again and brings back these memories of the last time she was upset and her reaction and what resulted from that. So this time, she set up housekeeping with another god, Kingu, and he comes to her and says, we've got to do something again. It's the same story over again. We've got to do something about these rowdy kids. Let's get them. And Tiamat's reaction this time is, yeah, I'm not going to sit back this time. This time I'm going to participate. In fact, I'm going to lead the fight. So she and Kingu get together to fight, and she creates 11 monsters to help her in the battle, and creates the viper, the sphinx, the mad dog, the scorpion man, the centaur, all these evil beasties that are in the world. And as they're preparing for war, the young gods hear about it again and get worried this time, because this time it's the old mother coming. And all the gods are terrified of ancient Earth Mother. Here she comes, the first one, the ancient powerful one, and she's going to get us. And Yah says, I can't fight her. Somebody else better. So they all look around, and Marduk stands up and says, I'll do it. And his response is different from his parents. Their response is, ancient Earth Mother, powerful stuff, dangerous. You've got to be afraid of it. His response is, what's to be afraid of? She's just a woman. If it were a man coming, we might need to be worried, but this is just a woman. No problem. So he gets up, gets ready for battle, and says, if I defeat her, I get to be king. I'm the best god anyway now, so I want to be king. And everybody agrees when he stands up and does some magic tricks that he's so powerful, it's fruitless to challenge that. So he confronts Tiamat with his army of monsters and finally says, in this conversation, I challenge you to hand-to-hand combat. Forget all your monsters. Let's do this. And just in the moment of confrontation, Tiamat, big Mother Earth, knees shake underneath her, and she loses her whole will to fight and agrees to the hand-to-hand combat, and really there's no battle. She gets some winds ready to blow, and Marduk gets his bag of winds and blows her open and shoots a bow, an arrow, inside her blown open mouth and explodes her. And then he creates the universe from her body. He cuts her in half, sets that up in the sky. Her bottom half he makes the earth and creates the universe that then the gods will live on, and sets himself up as king. And then later they decide, wow, this is a nice place. We need somebody to take care of things on earth. So they decide to create people to be the gardeners for this nice garden. So Kingu, who was involved in the war too, they go grab him, cut him open, take his blood, and make human beings as gardeners for the earth, sort of slaves of the gods then. End of story. A lot of bells should ring when you hear stories like that. I think lots of creation stories, many things are very similar. And in fact, that one actually influences early Hebrew myths, and there's some influences in Genesis of that particular story. But I guess point here is, in that particular myth, you can see a number of things, but one thing you see is the record of this memory of ancient Earth Mother, who was once in charge, wanting to come back, and sort of the rise of the new order of gods, male gods, taking over and destroying her. I think what's interesting is that the male gods then create the universe from her body, when originally the universe already was her body. But now it's the male god that does it and takes control over it by not the pre-existing feminine body being the world, but the sort of the male control. I'll cut it up, I'll put things where I want, now I run things. And that's often pointed to as the transition myth from matriarchal to patriarchal cultural organizations. Let me just stop there for a minute. Any comments, questions, or reactions to anything else in that story? Yeah.
Immediately I start thinking about reproduction rights. When mm-hmm. I think of, I haven't believed that new myths should be are being created or will be created. Now I think in terms of the ovum and the sperm put together in a Petri dish.
Well, that wouldn't have to be male control even then, would it?
I know, but I think in terms
of inevitably.
The concept is male.
Yeah.
But women are having reason to have that. Well, unless
there's
certain investment.
Let's put it this way: they don't invest a lot of research in ovum usually, which is possible.
Any other comments, thoughts? Yes.
I'm really struck by how military these things are compared to myths from India, creation stories from India. My favorite one from India has the grandfather of the gods creates Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and then as a kind of test, dies. And the corpse of the grandfather floats down the river, on the banks of which Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are engaged in prolonged meditations. And so this stinking corpse floats first by Brahma, who is offended by the smell and pushes it away. Then it floats by Vishnu, who is equally offended because it's disrupted his meditations and pushes it away. And finally, it floats by Shiva, who of course is the god of destruction in this triad. And Shiva thinks to himself, wait a minute, there is no creation, so how can there be death? So it must be the grandfather. So he picks the body up out of the water and carries it with reverence onto the land and gives it the proper kind of honorary funeral rites and proceeds to cremate it, at which point the grandfather then re-emerges and gives to Shiva the duties of creation. He's now to create the world because he's understood the value of the necessity of death for creation.
Mm-hmm.
But Shiva loves mean, horrible, hideous monster things. So Shiva proceeds to, with great delight, create all these monsters. And the grandfather has to then intervene again and give it somebody else to
do it right.
And
part of your point was just is less violent in the beginnings.
Yeah. All the stories of war have been built into at each step.
Yeah.
Is it really true that in most parts of the world, creation stories have to do with a battle and a takeover? I'm thinking about possibly American Indians or African Polynesian, Eastern, or is it just maybe that part of the world in Sumeria,
right.
Greek? What have you found?
Yeah, I don't think it's just that part of the world, but I think you get quite a variety. And I think what's often said is, and this doesn't hold up completely, but in cultures where it's a safe landscape, you get less violence and war taking place than in a place where things are relatively peaceful. And that doesn't quite work in Polynesia, which is a pretty safe place. But where the landscape is dangerous and your environment is dangerous, and also if you're newcomers to a place, and have to defeat the, and this is how I think the balancing works. If you having to come in as a nomadic people and wipe out who's there and take over, then your creation stories will be violent. And that's, any generalization I think doesn't quite work, but the Hebrew nomadic people coming together and inhabiting an inhabited land then, they've got to deal with the fact that this land is already inhabited too. And there's numbers of ways to deal with it. One is to create sort of war myths, saying good guys, bad guys, here's the guys that won. And in Hebrew myth, how violent is their creation myths? You don't, in Genesis, get wars taking place, and yet there are people that wandered in and said, here's your spot, here's this land, it's inhabited by the Canaanites, which were people who were agricultural societies with lots of matriarchal elements in them that worship Earth's mother feminine deities. And the Hebrew response to that was terrible, horrible. God is this male deity in a patriarchal society, so there's very little mixing that takes place. While sort of the Greek version of that, they'll incorporate lots of the feminine mythology in the battles that take place. But in the Hebrew origins, they don't incorporate much because the Canaan gods are, goddesses are abomination. And Campbell talks about sort of their mythic response, how they justify that. And you've seen his series when he emphasizes the second born myths that show up throughout Genesis, that their mythology is full of stories that emphasize the second son. And sort of that's their symbolic response to guilt for coming in and wiping out an indigenous people. So the Cain and Abel story, I mean, that's part of it, is a sociological myth to help make sense of the fact that they've been given this land by God that's already inhabited. So they tell stories. I mean, what's the Cain and Abel story? Cain, firstborn, remember the details of this? Firstborn son, Abel.
Cain was the hunter. Abel was the agriculturalist, and the hunter killed the agriculturalist.
Right. So they, both Cain and Abel offer offerings to God, and God says, I like Abel's offering, and Cain's he doesn't like. Because Cain is associated with farming, fertility, wrong religion. And Abel is the nomadic hunter farmer that the Hebrews are. And it is also the second one. God picks the second one because it's, he's the nomad. He's also the second comer. The first comer, the people that belong there, then get justified to be pushed away, and it's the second comers that are given sociological sanction. And that story is repeated over and over in the Hebrew mythology. And
what else do you have besides Jacob and his older brother was
Jacob and Esau.
Joseph
was the
youngest. Yeah, and it doesn't have to be just second. Joseph as the last born, same thing. Oh yeah, right.
David was not the oldest son in his family. Mm-hmm.
So, and then you get that tradition established, and pretty soon, when it no longer even has sociological impact, the stories still get repeated. Second borns get valued. Anyway, back to my history of cosmology. So you get, I guess what we've got, and I guess what we've got is interesting then, is because in some places, in some regions, you'll have this interesting mix that takes place. Like for the Greeks, you'll get, and I guess sort of the Greek version of this, maybe since we're going to look at the Greek creation, Greek mythology comes from two sources. There's Crete, Minoan culture, 3000 to 2000, 1500 BC, which is matriarchal, fertility-based culture. And some cataclysm takes place in about 1400 BC, wipes out Crete culture. And then the mainland Greece starts to take over, Mycenae. Mycenae is formed by invader nomads coming in with Zeus as their male sky god. They incorporate the mythology from Crete with lots of fertility deities, and it's hard to, because there's not much record, but to separate out who got what from where. But then you get the result as being Zeus, sky god, very dominant male patriarchal phallic culture for the Greeks, but lots of feminine deities that retain lots of power, like Athene, even Aphrodite, Hera, some. So you get that mix taking place. And what I'd like to do is look at sort of the Greek creation story, and then the familiar ones from Genesis, and then just talk about Blake's question, Campbell's question. How much is our image of God determined by sort of those historical points? And are they frozen? It's too much back there. Yeah.
Athena would be a good example of you have a very powerful female goddess, mm-hmm. but she sprang from her father.
Right.
So there's no woman involved in that, and shows that close relationship to a man.
Yeah.
So and how she was chosen as a patron goddess of invading. Well, you know, people from Athens came from somewhere.
Right. Yeah, and most of those goddesses sort of have histories when they were in charge. But Athena's a great example. Born from Zeus's head, there's sort of the male taking control of this powerful feminine goddess. So she's still under control, even though the fact that she remains feminine still says something. That sort of her counterpart Ares, male god of war for the Greeks, you'd think would get celebrated more, and yet she's always the one that's valued, and Ares is a laughingstock.
Because we like Athens. You know. Athens was the most developed and everything.
Yeah.
Athena was just from Athens, you know, Sparta and places celebrated Ares.
Right, and then the Romans loved Mars, their version, much more. He was much more respected than the Greek version. It just says something about the Greek attitude towards war, too, I think. But to take a look at Greek creation story, let me just sort of run through the details of this, and then we can talk about sort of what that says about those relationships, and then look at the Hebrew version. This Greek creation, I mean, our sources for this, a couple different places, but Hesiod, writing about 700 BC, writes in the Theogony most of the details down. He's sort of a farmer that's interested in the origins of all the gods, and he's telling sort of stories. He's in an age when writing exists for Greek, but is sort of recording these things from oral times. And Greek version of creation, in the beginning was chaos. There's chaos, nothing else existed. And out of chaos emerged a number of things, finally, one day. Gaia, Mother Earth, is first. Out of chaos comes Gaia, Mother Earth. And a lot of darkness and a little bit of sex comes too. So you get Tartarus, which is the dark places in the depths. You get Erebus, which is the gloom of Tartarus, and Dark Night, and then Eros, E-R-O-S, to have some fecundity take place. So Eros is a creative power, which in the darkness of night leads to things happening. And out of Gaia, and this gloom, out of herself, out of Mother Earth, emerges Uranus, male sky god. Mother Earth, and then you get that sort of image from sort of the time when the intermingling of matriarchal and patriarchal cultures usually results with a version of some male sky god and a earth mother forming a sacred marriage. So she gives birth to Uranus and then marries him, and from that union they give birth to the Titans. And that's these are the big old gods in Greek mythology who used to run things, from whom most of the other gods can be sort of traced back to, but they're not the ones that remain in power anymore. And of the Titans, the one that's important is the lastborn. It's interesting, it's lastborn for the Greeks too. And again, I think the reason is the same for Hebrews. They're a wandering nomadic people. wandering around. So Cronus, the last born, the wily and terrible son, of course, hated his father. They all do. And he plotted against his father and finally captured him when he was going over and castrated him with his own god implements. He's an agricultural deity, so he uses his scythe and takes over. And then marries his sister. So Cronus marries Rhea and gives birth then to some of the major deities in Greek mythology. Hestia, Demeter, Hera, Hades, Poseidon, and last born Zeus. And you know the story. Every time he has a kid, he knows what's going to happen. So instead of letting them wander off to grow up to finally take over, he gobbles them up. So everyone born in order, he gobbles up. And every time Rhea says, "Look, we've got a new child," she shows it to him. He goes, "Ah!" and gobbles it up. And the next time she says, "Look, we've had a child," and she doesn't learn very fast in these minutes. And he gobbles that one up. And finally, she gets the picture. So when she has Zeus, she says, "Not this time." And so wraps up a rock. Says, "Look, we've had a rock. We've had a son." And Cronus doesn't look. He just gobbles it up. And thinks he's eaten the god. In the meantime, Zeus is sent down to Earth and is raised on Earth. Reaches adolescence, the time for his hero quest, and he has his call, and his call is to go on a father quest, and his father quest is to kill his dad. So he goes up there, he gets all the old titans to help him, everybody takes sides, some of the other gods side with him, and there's this big war in heaven. Again, your mythological war in heaven, that, I mean, even in sort of Christian mythology gets the war, if it's not in Genesis, at least it sort of gets incorporated finally. So there's this big war. Long and short of it is, Zeus takes over and he does the same thing that his fathers have done before him. He castrates his father, or takes his male power away, and tosses his parts into the ocean, and that's where Aphrodite comes from, sort of out of the sea foam from the splash of Cronus's parts. And so then Zeus takes over as male sky god, and marries his sister Hera, and is the reigning pair in heaven. And then eventually you get the creation of people, and there's a couple different versions of that in Greek myth, but the Prometheus is the most celebrated one, where Prometheus, one of the sons of one of the original Titans, who one day goes down and starts making mud pies and says, "Wow, I can make somebody." So he makes a man. And he makes a bunch of men, and they're just sort of sitting around there like lumps. And then he gets Athena to come down and breathe the breath of life into them. And it's that breath of life, the union of spirit and matter, makes them alive. But they're still nothing. They can't learn anything. They're pretty stupid. And they can't evolve past a certain point until they get fire. So Prometheus says they've got to have fire to evolve. So he creeps up to heaven, and Zeus has decreed. The gods have all been interested in these things creeping around down there. They say, "Oh, that's kind of interesting, but let's keep them where they are. So don't give them fire." So Prometheus runs up there, steals it, gives it to him, and there's sort of consciousness, and creates this great flowering of culture in advance. Zeus then punishes Prometheus, straps him to a rock, and has his liver munched out every day. And in the meantime, they decide they have to have a counterplot, and that's where woman is created. So he goes and has Hephaestus, the smithy god, help create woman, this most beautiful, tempting object, to get to send down to Earth, and then they give her the box. You know this story. So into Pandora's box, Pandora's name is All Gifts. All the gods give her a gift to make her sort of beautiful and wise. And then in the box they put all the evils of the world. And they stuff them all in there, and also stick in hope. Shut the box, send it down to Earth, and say, "Hey, Prometheus, this must happen before he gets strapped to the rock, I guess. But how about this? Here's a woman. And Prometheus, whose name means foresight, says, forget it, I know what's going to happen here. But his brother, whose name is Epithemus, I think that's not quite right, but his name means hindsight. He says, wow, I'll take her. So gets her, and she opens the box, all its evil comes out in the world, and you get sort of the way things are. And so that's sort of Greek creation of human beings, consequences. Just think about that for a minute. I mean, I don't think that creation story impacts our image of God culturally or religiously very much. And yet Greek thought certainly does. So anyway, just the details of that story. And what does that story say about the Greeks' image of the relation between God, world, God, people, people in the world, and men and women? Any comments on that? Significant elements there?
Sucks for women.
Yeah. Well, that's it sucks, but in a little bit different way than in the Hebrew version.
Still sucks though.
Because she's the bringer of evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like the serpent.
And she's the temple.
Right. So and you can tell there the origin of this version of Greek creation is when Mycenaean Greece is running the show. This story isn't coming from Crete, matriarchal culture. You get positive images there. So women are I guess the only redeeming value, the only thing that shows a, I think that there's a difference there. Women are created in a separate creation from men, mm-hmm. and women are created by a higher God, mm-hmm. even. So you get Prometheus creating men, Zeus involved in the creation of women in this separate creation, and yet used to sort of bring about the downfall.
Well, was Athena Zeus's spouse?
No.
Okay. I mean, Athena was. I mean, what'd she do? She just watched this all happen? She breathed breath?
And she came down and you need some feminine fertility, so.
She breathed breath into the moon. And then that was it.
Yeah.
She pulled
the shot. But certainly consequences for men and women there. I mean, that sets up sociological hierarchy. Men in control.
Prometheus brought the fire down in what we think of as the highest level of functioning, consciousness.
Right.
Is male origin.
Mm. Yeah, and consciousness is the gift of the male. So that's Greek version, and there's Bibles in here. Let's grab a few Bibles and look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
Well, the other thing is the clear distinction between matter and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You form the body out of the dust and you breathe into it the breath, which fit with Genesis, but absolutely does not fit with Indian.
All right, and that's, I mean, that dualism that permeates Greek thought, permeates Western thought, gets incorporated into our whole tradition is very important. Which it's there's some elements even there of dualism though.
Dualism, but it's not matter spirit.
Yeah. But feminine male certainly split.
Yeah, sure.
But I thought it was interesting that most of the there wasn't very much organization. It was, you know, in our Hebrew.
Yeah.
Creation, it seems pretty organized and pretty, you know, God's really in control there. What your summary of Greek from chaos sort of sounds like it never got very organized. It was still chaotic, where the gods were doing different things and messing up and didn't quite work, and then they tried woman and still didn't quite work, but it's the gods don't seem like they're very
they seem
in
pretty
control.
Human.
Then yeah, they seem pretty human.
Yeah, and that, I think, I mean, that's a good distinction between Greek and Hebrew. Greek gods, all deities reside in the human breast, and that makes perfect sense. The gods look like the people, and they act like the people, and nature for the Greeks is a sort of this chaotic, capricious thing. So the gods are chaotic and capricious because the gods are associated with nature. With the world. And in Hebrew, God isn't capricious in that same sense. God is this principle of order. And God creates the world, but God isn't the world. So you get this different connection. It's made, the distinction is made very clear. God is not the world. There's a creator, and there's the creation. The creator creates, and the world looks like the God, but it's still, don't you ever forget that the world isn't the God. Yeah.
That's sort of tied to the fact there's only one of them, too. There's no argument about who's in power. If there's one God, it's one super patriarchal image of, you know, the father who makes all the decisions, and there's nobody there to say, hey, that's not a good decision, I don't agree with you, I'm going to do something else. When in the Greek culture, there's all kinds of gods going around who have different images of the way the world should be formed. That's, it simplifies things a lot.
You have Genesis 1, Genesis 2, enough in your mind, you can just quickly run through. What's the creation in Genesis 1? What happens there? Yeah.
Well, it's extremely orderly. It starts off with the separation of firmament and then water and land and then light. Mm-hmm. And then then the animals on the fourth day.
Yeah, so you get this progression of human beings,
sixth day.
And then it says, and God made them, man and female, he created them in God's own image. So the creation of Adam and Eve sort of happens simultaneously, equally. So that's Genesis 1, and then Genesis 2 gives sort of the second version of things, and it, which is a somewhat significantly different. And what's the difference there?
Out of man.
Yeah, that's the rib story.
That's why?
The rib story.
Yeah, that's the rib story. And that's the one we think of, I think, mainly, don't we, when we think of creation. I don't know. When you think of...
No, I like the mud one better.
Yeah.
Isn't it also true in Genesis 2 that the humans are created before the
animals? Yeah. Well, Adam is. Mm-hmm. So you get the world, then Adam's created, then... The animals and everything else prayed by, and he names them, then needs a helper, so does the surgery and creates Eve. So Eve is after all the rest. And then the fall, with Eve sort of bearing the brunt of things. So, I mean, again, what does that say about Hebrew image of God and people? And is that pretty similar to the Greek version or not?
Is this list supposed to be all myths or Greek myth?
All myths you can talk about, sort of give you sort of insight into that culture's attitude towards those things. But partly that question depends on whether you're talking about Genesis 1 or Genesis 2, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Genesis 1, one you like better, creates man and woman in the same creation. It doesn't go into any details about what the significance of that is, but there it is, and that's saved. It's interesting that that's there, even. Where Genesis 2, which has, I think, more cultural force, puts women after the animals. And there you've got sort of the super patriarchal Hebrew culture, putting women where they belong.
Isn't that cultural force, or is the culture force?
Both, I think. I mean, again, that's the question, chicken or the egg question. That it's the myths create the culture, culture creates the myth, and certainly that reflects
what we have.
It reflects them, and certainly that's the dominant, I think. Well,
is it possible that we, I mean, probably about how organized this is and how it comes out. My understanding is that the Genesis was probably written down in the form we have it sometime around the captivity, which is a lot later than the Greek stuff was getting written down. Is it organized because it got edited that way?
Yeah, and it's sort of the people who study these things and say where the dates come from. The one where Genesis 2 is thought to have been influenced by the Enuma Elish, the Sumerian stories of creating Adam and Eve as gardeners, or creating first human beings as gardeners for God. And that's the whole Garden of Eden emphasis on that one. While Genesis 1 origins, it's hard to tell exactly where they come from.
But Genesis 1 is sort of takes all myths into it, and it's definitely trying to, whereas other cultures, you know, worship stars and stuff.
Yeah.
It's stating plainly that God put the stars in their courses and fixed them.
And Genesis 1 is said to be 8th century B.C., about when that comes up, and Genesis 2 is earlier, Sumerian ancient tradition. Yeah.
But if the woman was created after the animals, that was because after all the animals were created, there still hadn't been created something that was quite other than what was necessary.
Right.
So it isn't that she was less than good or anything than the animals. She was at a higher level.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the problem of who is putting the emphasis on the story,
right,
that question needs to be asked.
Right.
But what we have are two stories that are intentionally different. And I think that some of that tension stays throughout the rest of the Hebrew scripture.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And in fact, it's interesting, in spite of the fact that the Hebrews were so extremely, in terms of their image of God, male-oriented, that you still get very strong feminine heroes recorded in the story still. And the fact that Genesis 1 would even be there, why is it even there if Genesis 2 is completely controlling? And those are the types of fascinating questions that I think, talking about them theologically, talking about God's will at work, what's that doing there, or looking at it mythologically as cultural creations, raise some of the real sticky questions. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's another way of looking at that too, that God saves the best till last.
Mm-hmm.
When you read the story of the fall, you have the great curiosity of the woman, the lack of curiosity.